Welcome back, friends and listeners. This is Red Eyes Radio, and you can find more at redeyescreations.com. I'm your host, Henrik Palmgren, and today we are talking with Robert Schock, a full-time faculty member at the College of General Studies at Boston University since 1984. He earned his PhD in geology and geophysics at Yale University. In the early 90s, Dr. Schock's geological analysis of the Great Sphinx of Egypt demonstrated that the statue is thousands of years older than the conventional dating of 2500 BCE, bringing him to worldwide fame. In the first hour, we are going to discuss the weathering on the Sphinx, its origin, the chamber underneath, and the mysterious Sphinx Temple. We'll also discuss Edgar Cayce's Association for Research and Enlightenment, the ARE, and the current situation in Egypt. Stay with us for more. Welcome to Red Eyes Radio, Robert. It's great to finally have you with us. I've known about your work for a long time. We've had many of your friends with us previously on the program, so this is going to be lots of fun to hear from you personally, of course. So first of all, thank you for coming on the program, Robert.
Well, thank you very much. I'm very glad to be here.
I know you've told the story, of course, many times, so I understand you might be tired of it, but maybe here in the beginning, Robert, for newcomers to this program and to your work as well, you can just give us the brief round down, if you will, on the Sphinx weather and dating controversy that you were involved in back in the early 90s, Robert.
Yeah, that's fine. I got involved in all of this because of the Sphinx, because of someone that many of your listeners know about, John Anthony West, who is now a very close and dear colleague and friend. And I was, young tenured faculty member at Boston University. I got my PhD in geology and geophysics at Yale University, so I knew a lot about geology. I know a lot about geology. That's what my PhD is in. And not only that, but my PhD specialty actually was the same types of limestones that it turns out the Sphinx was carved from. So to make a longer story shorter, John Anthony West, in the late 1980s, was looking for what he referred to as an open-minded geologist to come and look at the Sphinx from a sort of critical geological point of view to see if the geology and the geological evidence correlated with what the traditional Egyptologists thought, and that was that the Sphinx was carved de novo from scratch in about 2500 BC. So he, through some intermediaries, he knew another faculty member at Boston University he had been friendly with. We got together. He came to Boston University to speak. I had dinner with him, and that was the beginning of this relationship in the late 1980s. I had never been to Egypt before at that point. I first went to Egypt in 1990, specifically to look at the Sphinx, to look at the Sphinx from a geological point of view. I'll say that I was absolutely skeptical about any of these, what I saw as sort of crazy concepts that the Sphinx could be older than the Egyptologists thought. I mean, right. I was a Yale-trained PhD classical academic. I still consider myself a classical academic, by the way. But something that I feel I learned at graduate school, in a good graduate school, is that you really do follow the evidence. You need to look at the evidence and not dismiss it. So I went to Egypt, and the bottom line is, I didn't say anything right away, but I couldn't believe my eyes, because it just did not make sense looking at the erosion, looking at the depth of erosion and weathering on the Sphinx, the type of erosion that you see on the Sphinx, which is, to put it very simply, rain weathering, precipitation. Now, the Sphinx is sitting on the edge of the Sahara Desert. We know geologically that the Sahara Desert has been hyperarid. There hasn't been virtually any rain there to speak of. Not that will weather away limestones, as you see on the Sphinx and in the Sphinx enclosure. There hasn't been that type of precipitation for at least the last 5,000 years. So it's been hyperarid to a time before the Egyptologists said that the Sphinx was first created. So there's a big disconnect there. I knew as a geologist that climates had changed over time on the Sahara in previous millennia, before about 3000 BC, going back 6, 7, 8000 BC, you had periods when it was much more temperate, much more rainfall. So my first suggestion, my first thought as a geologist is that the core body, the oldest portions, must go back to that earlier period.
Mm-hmm.
I also saw immediately, okay, so I'm a dumb geologist, and I look at the Sphinx for the first time, and I remember this hitting me that the head is way too small for the body. It was out of proportion.
Yep.
And that was actually important to me as a geologist because this is a dynastic head. There's no doubt in my mind it's a dynastic head that is in the last 5,000 years. But I don't believe, and my first impression was that it was not the original head, that you had another head on it that had heavily eroded, heavily weathered, that it had then carved down. And that's why the head was proportionally too small. So those were two major observations that I made when I first got there. Furthermore, the Sphinx sits below ground level. Only the head sits above ground level. And to carve this structure, the Egyptians did not just chip away at the rock around it to free the body from the bedrock limestone. They actually carved multi-ton blocks, 10 to 50 tons or more blocks, and reassembled them in front of the Sphinx, is what's known as the Sphinx Temple. So all kinds of weird things were going on there. I was stunned and amazed, but I kept sort of my mouth shut because I kept thinking, well, the Egyptologists must know what they're talking about.
Right.
I must be making some mistake. So I went back a couple of times with West. We did further studies. A lot of different studies. I don't want to go into all the gory details right now, but one thing that was very important is that we did seismic studies around the base of the Sphinx. What we did in a nutshell is we took a sledgehammer, we pounded on a steel plate on the floor, on the bedrock around the Sphinx. I did this with geophysicist Thomas DeBecke, a very good Houston-based geophysicist. And what we were able to do is map around the Sphinx, underneath the Sphinx. What I was looking for was the depth of weathering below the Sphinx, because it could also tell me, independently of the surface features, approximately how old the original statue must be. We did this. I got amazing results back from that. Amazing in the sense that, again, it indicated a much earlier age than Egyptologists were saying. It indicated, in fact, that it had to be at least 5,000 BC on the conservative end. I would say now anywhere from 5 to 10,000 BC to put a broad range on it, that the core body, the oldest portions of the Sphinx.
Hmm. I mean, that's fascinating.
So, yeah. So this just blew people's minds on a couple of levels. Those that understood the evidence, I presented it to geological conferences. My geological colleagues understood the evidence. They essentially universally accepted, but they had no vested interest in when civilization began, when Egyptology, you know, when the Egyptians were first there. Egyptologists, on the other hand, said, oh, I was a crazy, I was a pseudoscientist. They hurled all kinds of nasty epithets at me. It was a very bizarre period from my point of view. I was just, you know, a geologist trying to mind my own business.
So we know that there's a lot of different aspects to this then that kind of these anomalies, of course, and some of them I want to ask a little bit more about. First of all, if we talk about the 5,000 years ago, obviously this has always been an interesting question to me, how we accurately can date the rain and the weathering at the time in Egypt. How do we compare this? How do we know that, Robert?
So the last 5,000 years, just to get a little chronology here, approximately the last 5,000 years, you have hyperaric conditions on the Giza Plateau where the Sphinx sits. You have it on the other plateaus in that area, northern Africa and Egypt, for instance, the Saqqara Plateau, etc. And how do we know that? There's a couple of things. One is we do actually have very good chronology on dynastic Egyptian structures. And you can look at those dynastic Egyptian structures and you can get a very good record of weathering. We actually have records from the Egyptians themselves of what the weather was like. Something that was very important to me on one of my first trips to Egypt in the early 1990s was to look at the Saqqara Plateau, which is, you know, a dozen miles from the Giza Plateau. So geologically, it's the same region, it's the same area, it's going to be subjected to exactly the same weathering patterns. And on the Saqqara Plateau, for instance, you have first and second mud brick, but are known as mastabas, a type of tomb, mud brick tombs, dried mud brick. These have survived intact, in wonderful shape from a geological point of view. They're simply dried mud brick. Literally, if you get even a little bit of moisture, a little bit of rain on them, for instance, they just disappear. So that right there clinches that, you know, it has been hyper-arid for the last 5,000 years. When we start looking in the geologic record, we can look at ancient soil layers going back stratigraphically. We can see what plants were living there at different periods in time. We can radiocarbon date those. We can correlate them stratigraphically from what plants were living there. You can get a very good estimate of how much moisture there was, what the temperature ranges were. So we have a very good handle going back well before the end of the last ice age, more or less several tens of thousands of years of different climatic periods. And it's actually alternating with more arid times, more temperate times, moisture times, more arid times. We, in the last 5,000 years, happen to be in hyper-arid times when it comes to northern Egypt, or all of Egypt, actually.
Now, I have to ask you, of course, you mentioned the Sphinx head, that this the current formation that it has, something that was carved later just because of the fact that you look at the size of it and it doesn't match the rest of the body. Have you come any closer to what you think was there first?
Oh, yeah. I can tell you what I think was there first, and this is based on a number of lines of analysis. I think it was a lion. I think it was a male recumbent lion with a full, you know, the mane and the, you know, everyone knows what a lion looks like, a male lion. And I believe that's what it was originally. Now, this is to a certain level speculation because we don't have direct evidence, but I think it makes sense. You've got the paws in front, the pair of paws, you've got the neck, you've got the whole thing seems to look like a male lion. You've got a tail on it that's still the tail of a male lion. And if you think of it as having the head of a male lion, that would have been a fairly large head. I think it could have tolerated, should we say, a lot of weathering and erosion before it got to the point where it needed to be recarved. And even being heavily weathered, if it was a male lion originally, there would have been enough material for it to have been carved down into the current head. Furthermore, what is the male lion? Leo, if you start looking at potential astronomical significance, the Sphinx itself points in that direction in ancient times toward Leo. So there's that type of evidence, I think, that suggests it may have been a male lion. Also, we know from pre-dynastic times and earliest dynastic times that the motif of a lion was common in northern Africa. So I think there's a lot of suggestion to me that it makes sense that it was a recumbent male lion originally. Then it was recarved. If you look at the face, I just want to make a couple comments about the recarving.
Yeah.
I believe it's probably an early dynastic recarving. I suspect that it actually could be before Old Kingdom times, which is when the Egyptologists specifically point to the Sphinx as having originated. I think the head actually might be a little bit earlier. Other people have actually suggested it might be a New Kingdom or Middle Kingdom recarving, but I think it could be earlier. Also, if you look at it, I believe it shows, and I want to be politically correct here, sort of Negroid Nubian African black features. And we know that in earliest dynastic times, there's a lot of evidence for African element, if we could call it that, you know, Nubian, what in America we would call black element, as being maybe dominant or having a very strong influence in ancient Egypt. Essentially, I was at a conference recently where many of the scholars there would say that essentially early dynastic Egypt was a black African civilization, if you put it in modern terms, at least that we use in America here.
Right. So before Old Kingdom, we're talking about the, you know, what, third millennium BC, something like that previously?
Yeah, yeah. So I think the head was probably recarved. My guesstimate, if you want me to put a name on it, a date on it, is maybe 2800 BC, something like that, early third millennium. But that's clearly a recarving on a statue that goes back thousands of years earlier. And I, that early statue was probably a male lion. So that's sort of my summary of
it. Interesting, male lion. I want to return to the lion, but briefly here, though. Do you think potentially that the nose then have been, you know, consciously destroyed to hide the potential features of the face, if I can put it that way?
Oh, the nose on the Sphinx currently?
Yeah.
I don't, my personal opinion is that it was not destroyed, the nose was not destroyed to hide the features per se, but I think that the nose was probably knocked off to, quote, kill the statue, because that's where you breathe, that's where the spirit comes in a sort of metaphysical sense.
Right.
So I don't, yes, it does destroy the features to a certain extent, makes it look less black or allows you to reconstruct it other ways, but I don't think it was done for that person. Purposefully, I think it was purposefully done to, quote, kill the spirit of the statue.
Interesting. That's a good point. I haven't thought about that before. You've also obviously looked at the interrelationship between the geological, if you will, then, and also the astronomical phenomena. Was this also the connection that you found then when it comes to the Sphinx and the potentially obviously connection to Leo, for instance?
Yes, yes. In fact, and I gotta say, I was very skeptical about this, so this is not where I'm coming from originally. I'm a geologist, and I've been coming from the strict rocks and what that evidence indicates. But it's interesting that when you start looking at the Sphinx, and if you reconstruct it as a lion, back in pre-dynastic times, thousands of years before the traditional dating, it in fact faced Leo rising on the horizon. The Sphinx sits absolutely due east, and you have situations where, for instance, you know, it's facing Leo rising on the horizon, where Leo actually is sitting on the horizon with the rump sort of on the horizon. So the, if I could describe it in words, the front of Leo sort of rising up, but still attached, if you would, on the horizon. I don't know if I'm describing it well, but what's important here is that the Sphinx itself has the same situation originally, something that I was able to reconstruct and confirm seismically is that originally the Sphinx arose from the bedrock. What I mean by that is an original version of it, pre-dynastic times, the rump actually married into the bedrock on the western end. So you had the statue essentially arising. Am I making sense?
Sure, sure.
From the earth, not unlike some of the later temples, for instance, in Egypt that are built into cliff sides, so they're arising from the actual bedrock. I think this was done purposefully and significantly, and what I found when we did the seismic work, and is correlated with the surface features I've been studying, is that the rump or the western end of the Sphinx was not freed up from the bedrock entirely until Old Kingdom times. And I think at that point maybe they lost the significance of it emerging from the bedrock, or maybe they just didn't care, or maybe it was just a practical thing when they were refurbishing and reconstructing the Sphinx that they carved out the western end.
Fascinating. Obviously, we're going to get into talking more here about things you have pertaining to your upcoming book, Robert, Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outburst. in our past and future. Fascinating work. I've been reading about the book, and it seems very interesting, and there's so much I want to get into there. But if we, for a moment, then kind of cling on to the Sphinx as we begin to get into this new subject, who do you think built it, the Sphinx, and why?
Well, who built it? When I say built, it wasn't actually built. I'm a geologist, so I don't mean to be picky, but it was actually carved.
Right, okay. You got
it. Bedrock. But what's interesting that you bring it up is, and I mentioned this a few minutes ago, but I want to come back to it. They carved the Sphinx from the solid bedrock. The body of the Sphinx sits below ground level, original ground level. When you go there, people that haven't been there, they're sometimes surprised. You actually go, you look down into the Sphinx enclosure, the Sphinx pit, to see the Sphinx sitting in what is sometimes described as a natural quarry. And that's a good description in some ways, because they did not simply chip out the rock. They simultaneously, with building the original Sphinx, carved out these huge blocks of limestone. We're talking tens of tons. They brought them out. They reassembled these limestone blocks, humongous limestone blocks, as what is known as the Sphinx Temple. So this original Sphinx Temple is contemporary with the original body of the Sphinx. That is thousands of years before dynastic time. So to me, in some ways, the Sphinx Temple is a much more interesting, much more enigmatic structure than the Sphinx itself, because I think it was even harder to build, and it's built simultaneously. So that being said, it's really amazing what was happening at such an earlier period.
Yeah.
But I honestly don't know who did it. I really don't know.
No.
In fact, this was one of the things that was said to me as over 20 years ago by some of the Egyptologists. Well, you know, if it's so old, who built it? And their point was, no one knows who built it, and therefore, you know, no one was alive at that time that could build it. People were just hunter-gatherers. They were too primitive to have built it. And I said, well, that's actually not my problem as a geologist. I can tell you geologically when it was built and how long ago it was built, but I'm not sure exactly who. Now, I have started to address this in my later work, and I mentioned this and start talking about in Forgotten Civilization, my forthcoming book, my new book that will be out in hopefully a few months. And the very title of the book in some ways indicates my thinking on it, that we do have a forgotten civilization. And I believe at this point that this forgotten civilization, as I'm calling it, goes back actually before the end of the last ice age. End of the last ice age, I date it geologically to about 9700 BC, and I believe that we now have real evidence, solid evidence, both in Egypt, in Turkey, at the site of Göbekli Tepe that I know you talked about in other programs with other people, and maybe we'll get into that today. But I believe we have solid evidence now for high civilization, if I could use that term, high culture, sophisticated stone working megalithic structures, among other things, before the end of the last ice age. And I think part of the issue here is that we have this civilization, or maybe, you know, I use the term civilization now in a broad sense. It may have been several different cultures that were interacting with each other. And there was geologically a major catastrophe, major changes at the end of the last ice age. And this is why this civilization, in my opinion, was destroyed. It was wiped out, and only vestiges remained until essentially civilization reemerged about 3000 BC, when the classical Egyptologists date the oldest civilization. But there was something earlier than that. Now, what we want to call them, you know, you can make up a name for them if you want, but we're really at the beginning, I believe, of a new understanding of our very ancient past. Something that's very interesting is I believe that the Giza Plateau, for whatever reason, and we can discuss or people can speculate as to why, it was a very important it sounds cliche, but I'll use it because I think it's genuine, sacred site, sacred spot, going back to very, very remote period. May have had all kinds of astronomical, and at that point, astronomy and astrology were essentially the same thing. Importance, why we're still trying to figure out. The ancients were clearly aware of things like precession of the equinoxes, of very slow changes. Somehow the Giza Plateau, where the Sphinx and the current pyramid sit, was a very important, very ancient spot. We see that even in earliest dynastic times, most people that have studied Egypt have some inkling of Egypt. They know that there was Upper and Lower Egypt. There was the two kingdoms of Egypt that were united, and that's generally seen as the beginning of dynastic Egypt. Where is the division between those two physically? It's at the Giza Plateau. Essentially, the Sphinx is a marker between the two kingdoms, the two realms. So there seems to be some very important significance there, which we're still only starting to learn, starting to really understand. And this ties in with the pyramids. And do the pyramids mark the sites of older structures? I think so at this point.
Oh, interesting. But as far as we know now, the Sphinx and the Sphinx Temple was probably the first structures on the Giza Plateau before the pyramids, right?
That is correct. I believe the Sphinx and the Sphinx Temple, which are contemporaneous, the oldest portion of the Sphinx, the oldest portion of the Sphinx Temple, and in my opinion, my analysis, those were the first structures on the Giza Plateau.
The seismic work that you did, what did you find? Is there anything else you can tell us about that?
Oh, yeah. It was very interesting. And a lot of interesting experiences due to the Sphinx. One was that when we did the seismic work, I did not want to do the seismic, you know, in the sense of looking for buried treasure, that type of thing, right, which frankly is what a lot of people use seismic for. What I needed was subsurface data because, as I mentioned before, I wanted to analyze my geological work on the surface. So I wanted independent geological data that, to use the language of science I learned as a graduate student, would either corroborate, confirm my hypothesis, or falsify it. And the best data I could think of getting, the most direct data, would be subsurface data. So we did that. And in fact, it confirmed, based on the depth of weathering, what I had concluded from the surface. So I felt very, very good about that. When we did the seismic, we also found all kinds of other things. We were able to map under the Sphinx. We found a tunnel which runs more or less, when I say a tunnel, it gets wider and thinner. So it's a tunnel type feature that runs from the paws of the Sphinx back toward the rump. We found a chamber or cavity under the rump of the Sphinx, which turned out we did not know about, but turns out that Egyptologists already knew about it. So that was good confirmation that our seismic data was accurate. Mm-hmm. And most importantly, we found a chamber under the left paw of the Sphinx, which some geophysical data previously, other types of geophysical data, had suggested there might be something there, but this had generally been dismissed. I feel very comfortable to this moment that our seismic data absolutely picked up a chamber under the left paw of the Sphinx. I absolutely believe it's there. Some people have tried to dismiss it. They've even claimed that they tried to drill into that region and not found it. I can address that in a second. But we found a chamber under the left paw. Now, this ties in with other things. So to give you a little story, Edgar Cayce, I knew who Edgar Cayce was. I wasn't totally naive back in the early 1990s, but I really did not know anything about him. I'd not followed his work specifically. I'd not read what he said about Egypt. I'm sitting in my office in Boston University. I remember to this day very clearly the phone rings, back then instead of email, phones, phone rings, and this guy's on the other end. He's in the ARE, what's that, Association for Research and Enlightenment, Edgar Cayce Foundation office, and he's all excited about what I had found under the left paw of the Sphinx, because he tells me how Edgar Cayce had suggested there was a hall of records around the Sphinx, or maybe even right under the left paw, etc. This was all news to me, but in fact, we had found it. So there seemed to be, you know, was that just coincidence or what? He also informed me that Edgar Cayce had suggested that the structures on the Giza Plateau, the Sphinx, the pyramids more specifically, went back to earlier periods. So he saw my work as reinforcing much of that. Now, again, you know, I'm not doing this because I want to support Edgar Cayce. I didn't even know about it previously, but it's interesting.
Very interesting.
What I can tell you is,
what else kind of work has been done on this? What other kind of work has been done on this from the point of the Egyptologists or yourself? Have someone try to get in there, open it up, or what?
Well, this is a big problem right now because I would love to get in there. I would love to open it up. I would love to drill into it. But so far, with the old regime, everyone knows that Egypt is in turmoil at the moment. Regime change, that type of thing. Under the old regime, I was never given permission to do that. Now, in all fairness, I was never told a blanket no, but never told yes either. And now things have changed, so now we're pursuing it from a different point of view. If you go on YouTube, for instance, you will find data that supposedly refutes me. I found at one point a video where Mark Lehner, the Egyptologist, and Zahi Hawass, who was formerly he had several different titles, but basically in charge of all antiquities in Egypt at one point, had for many years been in charge of the Giza Plateau, worked his way up, was, I think, before he was removed, or, you know, before the regime change, actually a minister. They drilled under the left paw. They claimed that they hit no type of cavity or chamber without ever saying my name. They basically were making it clear they were refuting me. I watched it. I saw what they were doing. I could see perfectly well the angle they were drilling at was such that it would clearly miss the chamber. It's you know, it's one of these things. I mean, there's a lot of politics involved here. There's a lot of bad science. There's a lot of misunderstandings. I was at one conference where I was speaking about the geological data. I just give you this not to be nasty to anyone, but give it to you as an anecdote.
Sure.
I'm speaking. One of my detractors, should we say, a scientist, supposedly. Well, I'll leave it at that. I'm sharing some of my data with him. He's having a hard time interpreting it. In fact, he was looking at some of the seismic data upside down because – Not to be nasty, he just did not even understand the scientific data well enough to know what was right side up and upside down. So there is really a disconnect in some cases. On the other hand, there are clear agendas and, you know, I guess they say all is love and what? Was it all is fair in love and war?
That's right, yeah, that's right. Is this a war then? Is that what this is about? A war about the past, about our,
Some people, my point is, some people are turning it into that. I do not see it that way. I see it as following evidence and trying to get the best evidence and being honest about it. And again, I'm not trying to make myself the good guy and them the bad guys, but there are very different tactics that are being used.
That's right. This video, by the way, you're talking about was uploaded back in 2009, and maybe then for the interest of people listening, I can link it up as well, so they can take a look at it and see what they think. It's uploaded by the Heritage Key media, which I believe then is connected to Hawass, you know, the antiquities at the time there.
Where they were drilling under, is that the one you're referring to?
That's the one, yep.
Yeah, and I mean, I can tell you, I watched that. I don't have it in front of me at the moment, but I like they're drilling at the wrong angle. I mean, we published in Geoarchaeology our data, so it's not like we're just talking about this. We published in good journals, etc. And, you know, what can I say?
Yeah.
I think Either they're ignorant or they know what they're doing, and they're doing it purposefully for other agendas.
Well, I wanted to actually ask you a little bit about that, because I've heard whispers and rumors of the fact that Hawass potentially had his, degree paid for by the ARE, things like this, that he was kind of, in a way, secretly actually working for them, and in one sense, outwardly covering up certain aspects of it, but behind the scenes, there is a totally different kind of research done. What do you think about that?
Well, I think there's a lot of evidence that supports that. Okay, let me back up a little bit with what is sort of public information. Mark Lehner, you're aware that Mark Lehner absolutely was associated with the ARE, with the Edgar Cayce Foundation. Mm-hmm. His initial funding, his college, et cetera, as I understand it, was, you know, he was supported by them. He wrote a very famous book, discussing little booklet discussing Edgar Cayce's, you know, prophecies. I shouldn't say called prophecies. Edgar Cayce's recounting of ancient Egypt, and part of Mark Lehner was supposed to be doing, as I understand it, or was planning to do, was to actually learn Egyptology, go to Egypt to support the Edgar Cayce writings, the Edgar Cayce understanding of the situation. Mm. Mark Lehner then totally turned the other way, became the most classical, dogmatic, this is my opinion, Egyptologist that there ever was, you know, closed-minded, in my opinion. Mm. Now, Mark Lehner and Zahi Hawass have been very close for many, many years, and I've heard exactly what you just recounted. And I do have some, should we say, inside information that would tend to support that type of thing. I mean, I don't, yeah. You know, I'm not someone that wants to speculate too much or say things that I can't absolutely support. But yes, there's certainly a lot of suggestions that one thing is being said, other things are being done behind the scenes. Certainly there was a lot of money from, if not the ARE, specifically from wealthy supporters, if I could put it that way, of the ARE, of the Edgar Cayce Foundation, supporting Hawass, supporting research in Egypt that would fit certain agendas and things being covered up. I mean, there's a lot going on. It's something that I learned over 20 years ago when I first got involved in this, is that it seems to be more politics than science in many cases.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah,
it's not something I'm happy with. I'm a scientist. I really am. That's my training. That's what I want to do. It's the science, not the politics. But there's politics in everything, but very much so in Egyptology.
If we, for a moment, then just take that, what you mentioned, at face value, if we assume that it's, you know, true, what we just talked about here, what does that mean? Because that seems obviously counterintuitive to what has been going on in Egypt. You would think then that the more, if you will, esoteric, interesting, alternative viewpoints would get highlighted in the type of research that has been done in Egypt, but not so. Why?
No. There's a lot of different politics going on in Egypt. When many people who are into the esoteric, you know, there are different types of people that can be in the esoteric. Some will want to keep it for themselves. They want to keep whatever knowledge. They want to keep this to themselves. So that's one speculation. People like Zahi Hawass and Mark Lehner, they have to work. If they're working in Egypt, they have to work within a political situation there. You have to realize that many Egyptians are not descendants of the ancient Egyptians. They're Arabs.
Yeah. They're
just like in America here, most Americans are not descendants of the Native Americans, the quote Indians, unquote.
Right.
They are Arabs. They're Muslims. I have literally had conversations with modern Arab Egyptians where they put down anything that's dynastic. I had one fellow, I believe he had a PhD, tell me that as far as he was concerned, to put it pretty bluntly, he would just knock down the pyramids and Sphinx and whatnot, build a good shopping mall like they have in Dubai. So there are very mixed feelings about these things. And if you want to survive in Egypt, as Zahi Hawass did until the regime change, and thrive in Egypt, you have to toe the party line. You have to hit the right balance. So it's really ironic that on the one hand, they'll be very conservative. They'll toe the party line, the standard Egyptological party line. And also remember, there was historically all kinds of influence from Egyptologists outside of Egypt. Most Egyptologists historically, they were from France, they were from Britain. They were not native grown, if you would. So they were bringing their own opinions in, many times racial biases, mm-hmm. depending on who you talk to. I was at a conference, which I mentioned before, where a lot of this came out, all the racial biases in classical Egyptology, many of which persist to this day. So there's a lot of sort of competing factions, competing thoughts. On the ground, I've often found that, you know, certain, we'll call it Egyptologists, but not in the sense of academic Egyptologists, more the tour guide types, they will tell the customer whatever they want to hear.
Right. Yeah,
that's true. It's just so much insanity and nonsense on both sides.
Yes.
You know, both the woo-woo side and the classical Egyptological side.
Exactly. It needs to be a balance. You know, the truth probably lies somewhere in between as well. I've always argued that these are two extremes, two polarized camps, if you will, that are just eager to being on the winning team in a way, and there's no kind of objectivity here in a sense, but you seem to bring some of that and some other people, I think, as well, so that's great.
Well, thank you.
If we, you know, by the way, before we move on then, I want to get into Forgotten Civilization, Göbekli Tepe, etc., but we've talked at length before with, for instance, Robert Pavel and some other people about this in the past. I want to ask you about this. Are you hopeful that Egypt now then, because of the, and we don't have to talk about the political situation in Egypt itself, about, you know, whatever way it might go, but if we look at the antiquity specifically in Egypt and the pyramid research and the Sphinx and everything, that this might be an area that actually opens up because of a new regime, or will it go in the opposite direction with maybe the Muslim Brotherhood coming in or something else? What do you think? What do you make of it?
The honest opinion I have is that it's too early to tell. I think it could go either way. I think either you could have something opening up and really allowing more work and research, because I've contended for many, many years now that what I've been doing, serious scientific research, pushing back, for instance, the age of the Sphinx, is not degrading to Egyptians or Egyptology. It's just pushing back to a new era, more to study is the way I would see it. Versus, you know, some of the Egyptologists. Zahi Hawass once, you know, more than once, accused me of, you know, stealing the Sphinx from the Egyptians because I was dating it back earlier. I mean, that doesn't even make sense to me.
Yeah.
It's Egypt. They were Egyptians. It just depends on how you want to define Egyptians. So on the one hand, I think maybe with a new generation of homegrown, if I could put it that way, Egyptian-grown Egyptologists, that might be open. One thing that you have in science, and you know, many people have talked about this, is that new theories, new ways of looking at things don't come about or don't become the dominant force because you convince the old guard. It's because you have a new guard growing up, new graduate students, etc., new students. They learn a different way of thinking, and then they can proceed from that. So maybe we'll have a new generation. Maybe we'll have a different way of thinking. Maybe the politics will allow that to open up. That is one possibility, and I hope that's a possibility. I really would like that to happen. I have to be realistic, though, and say that we don't know. It's a volatile situation. We could go the other way in Egypt. It could go the other way.
Yeah.
If certain elements come in, and they want to make it much more, should we say, strictly along religious lines. I have many friends who are Muslim. I have nothing against the religion, but there are certain elements, certain fundamentals in any religion.
Yeah, of course.
Who want to do things. And as I already mentioned, I've met many Egyptians who would get rid of the antiquities, many Egyptians who would sell off antiquities to museums around the world to raise money. This would create a huge problem, though, from a practical point of view. Egypt depends on tourism. There are many Egyptians in Egypt who are really dependent upon the antiquities for their livelihood. If they're destroyed, if they're sold off, if they're ignored, you could actually have an uprising within Egypt, and you could break up into really factions in a civil war. So
yeah,
it's very hard to know what's going to happen.
It reminds me then a little bit, if this is the truth, if you will, then, because I'm always, skeptical about the things we get from the mainstream media as well for various reasons. We've detailed that on the program in the past, but allegedly the nice big statues there in Afghanistan, the Buddhas of Bamiyan, were destroyed back in 2001, allegedly by the Taliban, and that's, you know, because they were idols, right? So they just blew them up. Right. This kind of echoes that type of mentality in a way.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, there's definitely that mentality in Egypt, if that's what you're driving at. There's
right,
no question.
Yes.
There's that mentality in Egypt. And to put my thinking very simply, if that mentality makes headway in Egypt and you start destroying, or even not destroying, simply ignoring and allowing them to sort of go, you know, be vandalized, not be taken care of, the different antiquities, the different ancient sites, if that starts to happen, and among certain groups, sort of religious priorities take over along those lines, you've got other groups that are going to be hit financially because of tourism going down. They're dependent on this, and you could basically be pitting religion against, you know, simple finances and economics, and you could potentially, in my opinion, have different groups of Egyptians pitted against each other, which would not be a good situation in such a country that's rather volatile anyway at the moment.
That's right. Internal strife, divide and conquer, civil war. This is not going to aid the scientific field in any way, that's for sure. We know that.
And I hate to say it, I'm not... it's a situation we were hoping everything would be stable in Egypt by now, and it's clearly not totally stable yet.
Yeah, that's right. All right, well, let's do this, Robert. We're coming up on a break here in a few minutes, and so why don't we spend the last few minutes talking about your website, obviously how people can get a hold of your new book once it's out, and then obviously we're going to pick up on this conversation and get into that specifically more in the second hour. And I also want you to mention your upcoming conference as well in California. So begin from the top, if you will, Robert, and tell us about the book, the website, and the conference.
Okay. I've got a new book coming out. It's published with Inner Traditions, and it's called Forgotten Civilization, The Role of Solar Outbursts in our past and Future. Because something that we'll get into later is the role of solar outbursts and how the sun has affected climate, has affected conditions on Earth in a very dramatic sense, and therefore affected civilizations, including that I think more solar outbursts are coming. We've heard a lot about that in the news recently, but we'll get into that. So the book is Forgotten Civilization. It's Inner Traditions. It's available for pre-order on Amazon and other sites, and you can get information on my new book, on my other books, previous books, and my tours that I do, and the conference that I'll be speaking at if you go to my website, and that's www.robertschock, all one word, and it's spelled robertschock.com. And for those that can make it, I will be speaking at the Yuga Cycle Conference in California. I've got a posting on my website for that. I'm very excited about it. And at this conference, I'll be discussing my work on the Sphinx. I'll be discussing the confirmatory work at Göbekli Tepe that, yes, we really do have a very high ancient civilization back at the end of the last ice age. So this is I'm very excited about this research, and I hope that people can come and speak with me personally about it. If not, go to my website, read my books. And that Yuga Cycle Conference is in late May. I believe it's over Memorial Day weekend.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're definitely going to add that link to the website. It's on the expandinglight.org website, but we'll add the link directly to the conference, and obviously there's some of our other friends there as well, Christopher Dunn, Walter Cruttenden, etc. So that's going to be great.
Yeah, it's in part associated with Ananda College and, yes, Expanding Light.
All right, excellent. And again, then the main website is Robert Schoch. That's Robert, SCHOCH.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back with more. Second hour with Robert Schoch, we continue to talk about his new book, The Forgotten Civilization. In the book, Robert reveals scientific evidence of advanced civilization predating ancient Egypt, Sumeria, and Greece, as well as the catastrophe that destroyed it nearly 12,000 years ago, and what its legacy can teach us about our own future. Combining evidence from multiple scientific disciplines, Schoch shows how the last ice age ended abruptly in 9700 BCE due to coronal mass ejections from the sun. These solar outbursts unleashed electrical and plasma discharges upon Earth and triggering volcanic activity, earthquakes, fires and massive floods as glaciers melted and lightning strikes released torrential rains from the oceans. He explains how these events eradicated the civilization of the time and set humanity back thousands of years, only to reemerge around 3500 BCE with scattered memories and nascent abilities. He explores how within this framework many megalithic monuments, underground cities, and ancient legends fall logically into place, as well as the reinterpreted Easter Island Rongorongo texts and the intentional burial of the 10,000-years-old Göbekli Tepe site in southern Turkey. Schoch reveals scientific evidence that shows how history could repeat itself with a coronal mass ejection powerful enough to devastate modern society. Don't miss the continuation. Hour 2 for members available right now at redicecreations.com. Click on members or subscribe to get instant access. You can also subscribe to our RSS feeds, check out the iPhone app, and subscribe to our newsletter. Our subscriptions are €5 per month. Try it out with a 3-month subscription. Full access to our archives of mind candy. Good stuff. Continue listening to Red Eyes Radio for more. Our next program is with Lucy Wyatt on her book Approaching Chaos. Then we have Håkan Blomqvist on the unique and very strange alien encounter case of Richard Höglund here in Sweden. After this, we have Mike Cross, Dean Clifford, Marty Leeds, J.J. Hertek, and Desiree Hertek. We also have Sterling Allen, Kurt Lindahl, Stefan Molyneux, Matt Stein, Jordan Maxwell, William Davis, Jay Widener, and Mark Weber, to name a few. Thanks for listening and for supporting independent, intelligent, and open-minded radio. We'll be right back with Robert Sharp.